Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan. With me today is Catherine McLean, PhD. Catherine currently lives and works with her husband, John, on the Happy Acres Farm in Sherman, Connecticut, where they raise free-range chickens, grass-fed beef, and a milk-fed baby named Francis. Catherine earned her PhD from UC Davis, working on a four-month study called the Shamatha Project, monitoring the effects of a long-term meditation retreat on the brains and personalities of subjects at the Shambhala Retreat Center in Colorado. She also most recently worked as a postdoc researcher and sitter at the famous Johns Hopkins psilocybin studies, where she co-authored a number of papers and was the lead architect of the currently ongoing study of the effects of psilocybin on longtime meditators. She has also volunteered at the Zendo Harm Reduction Project at Burning Man and Africa Burn, and with Roshi Joan Halifax's Nomads Clinic in Nepal. She has also been a regular on the psychedelic speaking circuit in recent years. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for sitting with me today.
Thanks for coming all the way to my home at Happy Acres Farm in Connecticut while your family's here for the Horizons Conference. It was a real pleasure to walk around the pastures with you and show off the animals.
I wanted to talk with Catherine because she is a brand new mother, and I've been begging her to be on my podcast for quite some time, and I remember she said, I'm going to write an article for your webpage, and it'll be why I'm not taking psychedelics right now. And I thought that was very funny and quite apt, because as she said, being a brand new mom is a mind-altering experience in and of itself, and not necessarily needing to mix other things into that right now. But she has many other interesting stories to share. I do want to talk about something, Catherine, that you mentioned in a recent Facebook post. You posted an article about sort of cry it out versus providing lots of protective nurturing to your baby. And there is a really interesting kind of discussion that arose out of that. And I'd like you to share your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, you know, you don't really know what your parenting style is until you have a child. And I had taken care of other people's children quite a lot. And I have a brother who's 16 years younger than me, so I was around when he was a baby. So when I had taken care of other people's babies before, I had a sense about myself that I would be a more kind of on the nurturing side of the spectrum than a, you know, let's help this baby prove its independence, you know, at 8 weeks old. But something else kicked in for me when I had my own child that it became very difficult for me to personally, on a visceral level, hear her in pain or distress. So her cries were literally painful for me, mm-hmm. which basically meant there's no chance that I'm going to be training her to do anything that involves crying a lot.
Right.
So just at a very selfish level, I'm not going to be able to do it. And then it also became clear to me that I couldn't justify putting her through any more pain than was ever necessary in a world that I have found to be fairly painful. And when I reflected back on how my experience with psychedelics had prepared me for this, I realized that I had guided adults through all sorts of really dark territory and intense territory on especially psilocybin when I was working at Johns Hopkins. And I thought to myself, you know, how many of these adults were overloved as babies and as children? You know, we don't have a problem with loving too much in our culture. And if I can change the world through this one human being who's just arrived, then that seems like a perfectly viable way to spend all of my time and energy for now. And to teach her that the world can be a soft and gentle and loving place, even if it's just me and my husband on this farm, I hope that that makes a difference for her so that when she becomes an adult, maybe she doesn't have as much stuff to work through so that she can be more helpful to others. What I kind of learned through my Buddhist training is that until you learn to really love yourself and be okay with yourself, you can't be of service to others. And I know people have taken issue with that, but time and again, I've seen that the people who are the most clear about their own sense of self-worth and love for themselves are able to be much more compassionate and helpful toward others. So yeah, it all kind of came full circle for me that there's no way I'm going to instill a painful situation for my child And hopefully it means that fewer people will actually have to resort to the kinds of medicines that I think are really helpful. So I don't know. In the future, I envision people won't need psychedelics as much, or they'll be few and far between to address issues other than childhood neglect and trauma.
So last week I interviewed Neil Goldsmith, and he talked about his own theory of personality development and how he sees the soul or the original self as being this pure thing that is kind of covered over or shielded by personality that is built around either youthful trauma or a desire to please or draw attention to oneself from parents. So either in a desire to hide the parts of our personality or our true self that we think that our parents will reject, or a desire to amplify aspects of our personality that our parents will like, that we create this self, this sort of false self around that sort of shields the soul or the actual self. Does that seem to be like something that rings true to what you're addressing?
I kind of see both. You know, I think when my daughter was within the first 24 hours of her life, I saw her soul and I saw her personality. So it felt like a lot of the foundation was already there for both. And maybe what happens with age is that the personality piece gets really built up and the soul piece kind of gets, you know, dampened. At least in our culture. I'm sure there are other cultures where you either have less of the personality buildup or kind of more of the soul cultivation. I can't tell if it's a developmental thing or a personality kind of a reward-based thing. But, you know, she was very serious and intense for the first couple months. And just within the last few weeks, she's become, quote, more happy and content and, you know, wants to interact more and make lots of facial expressions beyond just kind of serious focus. Yes. So what is that? Is that just a developmental thing, or has she already learned that she gets better reactions from us when she smiles more or interacts with us or, you know, flirts with us to get picked up rather than cries? And so it's really, even if, I guess what it comes down to is, even if the personality is already getting built up, I would hope that both things can be cultivated. Her personality, because the personality or the ego serves us really well. And a healthy one is great, and not many people learn how to develop a really healthy ego. So I would love to see her develop her own wonderfully healthy personality, whatever it is. And the soul gets not dampened. So yeah, rather than seeing the personality as something that needs to kind of be stripped away, I think it's great to support a really healthy development. Which actually reminds me, a Zen teacher of mine once told me that Krishnamurti tried to come up with a kind of early childhood education that would prevent the development of ego so that you then wouldn't have to lose it as an adult. And it totally didn't work.
Yeah.
So either his approach didn't work, or it's not really possible to bypass that. You can't just like be born into a non-dual space and stay there forever. It's like we're here to develop individual personalities.
Yeah.
And then once we have a healthy one, we can do all sorts of things with it,
yeah,
including practice dissolving it.
And from my perspective, the ego is rightly seen as a tool as opposed to like the enemy. Like when my own psychedelic experiences have sort of pointed to that, we go into these spaces and we dissolve the ego and we get to this place where like you're in this realm of imagination and there seems like everything's possible. But when you wake up the next morning and you want to take that sort of infinite possibility and do something with it, it like requires the ego as a tool to actually make something happen. So tell me a little bit more about your experiences at Johns Hopkins with helping people to heal from childhood trauma.
Sure. For the most part, the work that I was doing was with healthy individuals. So if someone had really serious trauma, they were most likely screened out from that particular study. But what we did see which is really unfortunate. I think it's just the reality for a lot of young girls around the world, is that a lot of women who went through the study, even though they passed screening, were psychologically healthy, had never sought therapy, quite a number of them first revealed either during the preparatory meetings with the guides or on the psilocybin sessions themselves, revealed that they had been abused as children. And I remember when it happened with the first young woman I was working with where this came up, and I asked Mary Casimano, who's been working on the project since the very beginning. And I said to her, I said, you know, is this common? And she said, it's unfortunately more common than you are kind of aware of, that this is something that a lot of women have never talked about, probably never sought therapy for, and maybe in their families were made to just suppress it and not talk about it. And so Mary wasn't necessarily surprised, and I think it's a testament to the clinical skills of the team that we had that some of these women felt comfortable enough for the first time in their lives to talk about this with strangers. I think it also speaks to the power of psychedelics, not just while they're in your system, but when you know you're about to take a psychedelic, you really want everything clarified. And if you have the right support in setting intentions and preparing yourself, you don't want to leave anything out. And I think for some of these people, it was an opportunity to, in a safe, supportive setting, clear all of the material. And so it's like the stakes were high and the motivation was also high to really work through stuff that people had never gotten an opportunity to share about. And some of it was sexual abuse. Some of it was neglect. A lot of it was just kind of like, a friend of mine talks about the way we brutalize children, but it's not that much different than the way humans are brutalized throughout their lives in a lot of cultures. You know, it's this kind of subtle way of making people feel not good enough. And so that's kind of what I saw more of, is just this perpetual feeling of I'm not good enough, and finally on this high dose of psilocybin feeling complete, that all the parts had been cleared up and kind of put back together. What's interesting about that piece is that we use synthetic psilocybin, but if you talk to traditional mushroom healers, the mushrooms and the mycelium, it's about weaving things back together and helping people connect parts that are broken and disconnected. And I saw that happening a lot in sessions with healthy individuals. You know, people would come to us and say, I want to learn meditation and take psilocybin for the first time. And what would really happen is they would kind of go back through their history and find all the holes and the parts of themselves that didn't quite fit. And it seemed like the psilocybin helped fill those holes and reweave those connections. For some people, it was a death that occurred when they were younger. One woman I worked with, her sister died when she was a teenager. And still 20 years later, this was a major hole in her family. Not to say that she hadn't healed from it quite a bit sober, but this was an opportunity to finally go back to that raw wound and help kind of clear it out and heal it. In another case, a young man that I worked with, he had grown up in a cult-based religion. So a lot of just weird stuff that he was still working through as an adult that had just gotten imprinted when he was young. And, you know, then there's just the kind of run-of-the-mill stuff. I mean, stuff that, like, I went through as a young child with divorced parents. Nothing that is really the end of the world, but it can feel like the end of the world to a child. You're taking the two caregivers who've always been around, and all of a sudden they're separate. And you have to spend time with one, but not the other, and then switch. And so ways in which your mother makes you feel are not the ways your father makes you feel. And all of a sudden you have to have them separately rather than together. And so it's kind of run-of-the-mill stuff like that, which I would say is pretty common in America, to the really serious stuff that people had never felt comfortable talking about.
So tell me some more about being a new mom and how your psychedelic experiences have prepared you for that. And one thing you specifically mentioned, we were talking about doing this, was about an ayahuasca experience you had that said you felt like it prepared you for being a mom.
Sure. In a way, I feel that every experience I've had personally and supporting others with psychedelics prepared me for motherhood. And there's a very good reason that for me it took 33 years to get to the point that I felt I was mature enough and had sorted my own stuff through enough to do that. I've wanted to have a child since I was young. Like when I was 20 years old, this feeling first hit me that this was going to be the most important thing I did with my life. And I feel like my path through not just psychedelics, but meditation, and even my path through science and academia, all of it was kind of an initiation to prepare me for this task where I feel life and death are apparent every single moment, and there are no breaks. The most obvious starting point to the birth of my daughter was when my sister died, and that was 2.5 years ago. My sister actually was very precocious in terms of family. She got married almost right out of college. She had a child very soon after that. And so by 25 or 26, not only did she have a young child, but she was all of a sudden diagnosed with cancer and facing this terminal endpoint. So it's like everything happened really fast for her. And there was, I didn't have a sense of what that was like to be a mom and to be facing my own demise. And so I couldn't really empathize with her situation beyond the surface level of, well, that sucks a lot. When the cancer came back a few years after she had first been treated, it was a very rapid decline, and she died within a month and a half of when it first recurred. What happened for me after that point was I became very close with my niece, her daughter, very close with my sister's husband, and It felt like my relationship with her daughter was also preparing me. You know, what is it really like to be one of the primary female figures for a little girl? And I remember I joked with my sister's husband. I mean, it's like this horrible scenario. My sister had just died and we had to go to the mall because I had nothing to wear to a funeral. And I hate malls. I mean, they're hell. Like, and I had to go right after my sister died and find this like perfect piece of like black clothing, basically. Well, I had watched my niece many times before. She was 4 years old at the time. And as soon as we walked into the mall, this thing went through my body and I was all of a sudden like scouting out all of the people. It was this hypervigilance mode. I needed to know where my niece was at all times. And my heart was racing and I kind of felt like I was about to panic. And I was like, Ryan, my sister's husband, I was like, is this what it feels like to be a mom? He's like, yep. And it was just like, I had no clue. I had watched this child so many times and had no fear about her safety. And all of a sudden, with my sister gone, I immediately felt that, I don't know, that weight had been transferred to me. And our relationship developed over time, but where my sister's death led me to eventually was this my first and so far only experience with ayahuasca. One could say that my set and setting was the worst possible you could imagine to first have an experience with ayahuasca, but it was also necessary. It was almost a year after my sister died, and I was in such intense grief and despair that I kind of felt like there was no point in living. And it's so foreign to say those words now because there's so much I feel like is worth living for now. But at the time, I think the way depression screws with your sense of reality, grief can also. And I wanted so much to be with my sister again that the only way I could figure out how to do that was to basically join the dying team, you know, be on the side of death because that's where she was. So when I went into ayahuasca, my friend who was a shaman said, you should go in with a question. And I said, I want to know where I came from. And she said, what do you mean? I was like, I want to know where I came from before I was born. She was like, okay. Like, you're kind of basically like you're in for it. Like, that's a big question. So we drank together and I had a friend with me. So it was just the three of us. And I kept trying to go to these supernatural places like, oh, maybe I came from here or there, like, you know, past lives and fun stuff. And it's like the medicine just kept pulling me back to this really painful core of the grief. And I was like, well, screw this. Like, I didn't come here to, like, experience even more how I've been feeling. Like, I need some relief. And it's like, the medicine was just like, no, this isn't about relief. This is about showing you really how painful what you're experiencing is and how it is beyond you. It's not just your pain. And over and over in so many different ways, I felt viscerally the pain of not just my own grief of losing my sister, but what it was like for her to die and say goodbye to her daughter for the last time. Not just that she wasn't just losing her life, she was also losing her daughter. And I also viscerally felt my mom's pain of losing her daughter and seeing her only other daughter in despair. And it was just like these fractal layers of just the pain that is at the core of the mother-child relationship. And of course, it's more than that. But it felt to me that what ayahuasca was saying was, in the moment of birth, it is that separation. And we have all gone from whole to separate. And that pain of separation is underlying so much of what we do that's crappy to ourselves and others. That we're just looking to heal that initial pain when we were separated from our mothers, whether we know it or not. And yet it was also showing me what it's like from the mother's point of view, which I couldn't possibly know until that point. So the experience really spiraled, and it was so physically painful. I remember being like, this is not a psychedelic. This isn't familiar. I've never experienced anything like this. It was just all physical pain. And like at the core of my abdomen and just radiating out. And I remember just looking at my two friends, the shaman and my other friend, and thinking like, why is no one taking care of me? And that's when I think in a classic psychedelic sense, I kind of regressed to that point of being a child, maybe 2 or 3 years old, and feeling like there was a pain that no one could fix. And I was looking at the adults around me like, why can't you see how much pain I'm in? And it was so, it was such a lonely space. And kind of going back to the cry it out, I feel like that's what children experience a lot when they are left alone. And yes, we learn to cope. We learn to self-soothe. But that pain, that core pain is still there. And for me, it came up so clearly with this first experience with ayahuasca that I was like, this isn't made up. This isn't like an experience I wanted to have. This is the opposite of what I wanted to have happen. So I finally am just laying on my side feeling like totally like abandoned. And miraculously, my friend's dog, and she said he's never done this in ceremony before, he came up to me and laid his entire body against mine, like almost like we were spooning. Mm-hmm. And I felt finally like there's at least another being on earth that knows what the pain I'm in and would like come help me. And I remembered my own dog from when I was a kid and how that relationship was always there, even when all the adult stuff didn't make sense. And, you know, I was being shuttled back and forth between parents. And so it was this like, it was a really interesting perspective on the motherhood, being a child, how children seek out companions beyond the human realm when the adults just don't seem to have their shit together. And finally, what came out of the session, what I'm leaving out is there, I had just returned from a trip to Nepal, and I won't get into that too much, but basically Nepal was an attempt to kind of start fresh, and I almost felt like I could just leave everything behind and just start my life in Nepal and never come back, and that would be a way of dealing with the grief. And what ayahuasca said is,
you're not going anywhere. You're going to go back home to Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And you're going to live your life near your family. And you're going to have a child. Mm-hmm. And on top of all of that, you're going to stop drinking. And I was pissed.
I was like, fuck you. You know, like, no, you can't tell me what to do. I'm not going to just move back home. And
mm-hmm. I was like, wait, so I have to go back home, live near my family, face all my pain, and I have to stop using this one thing that I'd been using since I was 18 years old mm-hmm. to cope with anxiety and all of the like crappy feelings on a daily basis.
I was pissed, I was depressed, and that was the space that it left me in. So this is where you say, like, you need to work on the ego and integrate experiences after you've had them. So I came out of this experience thinking ayahuasca was, like, horrible, one of the worst medicines ever, that, like, maybe I had not even been given the right, you know, stuff, because it just seemed so bad compared to what everyone had described. But there was a place where I really trusted what I had experienced, because it felt so true to my own experience, that I was like, this isn't made up.
And not to say that I was drinking any more than anybody else, but for me, it had become a crutch. And perhaps that was the most difficult lesson to hear, but the most necessary. And I think that quitting alcohol, I ended up finally stopping drinking in May of 2014. I quit well in advance of getting pregnant. And I think that that allowed my body to clear out that toxic state from the last more than decade of my life, so that I could actually nourish a new life.
So whether it was ayahuasca or me telling myself, this is what you need to do, it had set the goal. And I went home, and within a few weeks had started therapy, and it was bad, and it at points it got worse before it got better. And it took almost a full year for me to fully appreciate and understand the message of that whole, what you call, like, a pain body, you know, the mother child and all of that. And once I finally understood it, I said, okay, I'm going to be a mother knowing that it is this painful. Not I'm going to be a mother and it's somehow not going to be as painful as it has been in the past for anyone else. It's probably going to be just as painful at times, and I'm still going to do it. So in a way, it's like, I think the ayahuasca experience took off all the sugar coating of what I thought, oh, it'll be fun. I'll have a baby and we'll do, like, all the cute, like, mother-daughter things together. It's like, no, it's like, this is real. So you have to go into it knowing the full scope that either one of you is going to die before the other. And from the moment of that birth, the next point, you know, the next point in that spectrum is death. And in my mom's case, you know, it's her daughter died before she did. And a lot of people lose their mother, obviously, before they die. So it just took everything, birth and death, and just wound it all up into one. It was like, here you go. Yeah. This is it. This is why we're here. So
it makes me think about, like, the Catholic theology of the Virgin Mary, and one of the titles of the Virgin Mary is Our Lady of Sorrows. And she, in the image, is that she has, her heart is, like, exposed, and around her heart is, the above her heart is a rose, and around her heart is the crown of thorns that her son wore on the cross. And so it's like she carries that wound, and there's that, you know, the Pietà, that image of her, like, holding her dead child in her arms as he take him down from the cross. And I have I made a friend just this year who was, her daughter was an employee of mine. And I met her on the day that her daughter died. And she had to come to my office and tell me that her 22-year-old daughter was dead. And since that time, I've gotten to know her better and just see the way that she's, like, starting to just finally use that energy, that sorrow, to, like, sort of propel herself into whatever's next in her life. And, you know, as a father of three, I can't even begin to imagine how to put, I can't, like, put myself psychologically into that space to, like, even begin to know what it must feel like, you know? But, you know, we make sacrifice. It's a sacrifice to be a parent in some ways. You have to, I was just talking to someone yesterday about, well, I'd love to just, you know, go to Horizons and go to a bunch of parties and all that kind of stuff, but I brought my 9-year-old son with me, so, but, you know, the excitement in his face, like, he got to fly in an airplane today and tomorrow he gets to like go to the Natural History Museum. He's a huge fan of those Night at the Museum movies with Ben Stiller, where he's like the night guard at the Natural History Museum, and seeing joy in your kid's face when you've like, you know, I spent months like saving up money for this trip, and just because it's going to make him happy, and it's worth it, you know, it's worth it.
That makes me think of something that I've been reflecting on, this idea of like people will say things to you like, you know, getting your life back or returning to normal, or, you know, once they start sleeping through the night, then you'll feel like you have your life back, kind of things. And in a funny, because of everything I just went through, it feels like the previous portion of my life is not something I'm returning to. And whatever there was that was normal is so not even in the realm of my current life that right. There's no returning to that either. Sure. And so what I have actually found is that surrendering to my daughter's life is way more joyful than needing to get my own life back. And every time I feel that kind of desire come back, like, oh, I'd like to be able to just go off and do this thing on my own, or, you know, I wish I could just, you know, go into New York City without having to figure out how to carry her on my body the whole time and feed her, and like, what if she's upset, and, you know, what if her ears are like, shouldn't be exposed to loud music, and, you know, the freedom of just being able to walk out the door and go somewhere.
It takes hours when you have a child.
But it's like, it's also such a relief, because I used to spend all this time worrying about myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To what end? It's like ruminating on something that you mostly don't do anything to change for the most part. And now it's like whatever that 99% of my brain was devoted to is devoted to her. And it's a relief. And so in a way, I feel like if you approach parenthood as a monastery, it's a really effective contemplative practice.
That's awesome.
It also can be totally non-contemplative, and that's fine too. But for me, having the contemplative training and the psychedelic experience, it feels like she's the perfect teacher for me now. And so instead of saying, like, what do I have to teach her or train her to do? I'm like, she's teaching me and training me. So I should just say, thank you. I'm going to show up every moment you need me, and like, yeah. Tell me how to be more joyful, because that's what was missing from the first 33 years of my life, is like how to have that kind of joy. And not to say that I didn't have a great life, because I did, but there was something always missing. And I think that missing thing is what led me through all of these explorations. And so a friend of mine actually said, Julie, so there's a connection to the psychedelic community. It's Julie Holland's husband, Jeremy Wolfe. He said, innocence is the only thing you lose as you age. And this was when we were sharing my birthday together, a bunch of us together this June, right before I gave birth. And I said, well, Jeremy, I'm trying to get mine back. And I feel like this relationship with my daughter is my opportunity to regain my innocence and experience the world through her eyes. And it's like, what else should I be doing? I mean, it's amazing, that opportunity. It's like everything else is nothing in comparison to that, including sleep. It's like, who cares if I get enough sleep or when I get it? It's like, I have this amazing opportunity that, I don't know, it's just, my mom was over here today. She lives nearby. And she and I have the same kind of parenting style, that we'd rather just hold our babies. And it just like brings us a lot of joy just to hold them. And other people, fine if you don't want to do that. I get it. But it's like, I would just love every minute with her. And I said something to my mom, you know, my sister expected to have a big family, and instead she got cancer and she died. So what if this is my one chance? And, you know, people say, I want two kids or three kids or whatever. I mean, it's such a gift to have one. And you really don't know. And I think if my sister hadn't gone through what she went through, it would just be an intellectual exercise for me to say that. Instead, I'm like, no, for real, you do not know what's coming. Your whole life can be just taken from you. And in the face of that, I'm not going to look back and be like, oh, I should have taught my 2-month-old to sleep on her own earlier. I'd be like, wow, I got to hold her almost all the time for the first year of her life.
First of all, you know, I want to say like you, my mother and father live fairly close by, and it's such a blessing to, you know, Nicole and I lived in Sacramento, California, and we got pregnant with our first child, and we came back to Michigan. We didn't really want to come back to Michigan. Every time I have to scrape the ice off of my windshield, I tell my mother that she better be thankful. But it's having family, having your parents close by is such a joyful blessing, I think. And being tied up in that sense of extended family, you know, even for somebody who's like alternative or countercultural as the two of us are and other people that we know, there's something just so crucial about that, I think, especially when you have a family that's loving and supportive and wants to be there for you and to be there for your children. It's an awesome thing, I think.
Something that I felt came with, in the wake of my sister's death, a level of maturity relating to my parents. And this is still ongoing because it's like I can't fathom the depth of their grief from losing their daughter. But I feel like her death has forced the three of us to really, it's like a reckoning of like, how was it that we lived our lives when, you know, they were young and we were kids and everything was kind of, they did their best, but it was, disjointed and unpredictable because, yeah, it's like divorce is tough when two parents are working and they're living in different places. And so in a way, it's like forced all of us to kind of revisit that. My husband and I actually lived with my dad for a year after we moved back to Connecticut. And I think that was in ways one of the toughest years of my life. And I wouldn't trade it for anything because the ways in which I were able to see my dad and him to see me and to kind of get to know each other again as adults, mm-hmm. You can't do that not living under the same household because there's always a way to hide. There's always a way to say, well, not this week, or I'll just put it off. I won't call. I had lived with my mom the majority of the time, the rest of my life, so, you know, growing up, so I'd already had that with her, but I see in them the joy that comes from being able to be around a baby again, and especially that it's a girl, you know, and I think when my sister died, it wasn't a 29-year-old woman who was dying. For them, it was their baby girl. And now, now they get to experience that again. And it's also wonderful to see that they recognize that, you know, Frances isn't a replacement for my sister, and neither is their other granddaughter, but it's kind of getting to practice again those feelings that they had for my sister when she was really little. And yeah, it's just so many layers of that if they weren't close by, I think my journey through motherhood would be very different. And again, going back to the lessons from that ayahuasca experience, it's like the joy and the sorrow and the pain, and like it's all right there. And you can't just say, I'm going to pick a life where it's like all good without being on that edge. It's like if you're on that edge, you're going to experience the most joy and probably the most pain and all of it. But that's where I'd rather be living the rest of my life.
I think, you know, people that I talk to have teenage children, they say like eventually your kid is going to tell you that they hate you, and it's like you're going to get stabbed in the heart by your own child, you know. So like I think that's the sort of humorous part of that, but I think it's true. Like my own ayahuasca experiences have consistently pointed to the fact that for me there's no spiritual development without suffering, and that we can't heal other people without suffering ourselves, that there's like no healing without sacrifice of some sort, that there's like a conservation of joy in some way. And when in order to like give other people joy, that we have to like give some of it up in some way. You know, I mean, there's a universal sense that like joy is joy and there's more of it, but there is really like sacrifices required when you love, I think. And pain comes along with it. We can't, like you said, we can't hide from it. We can't be like, it's not going to be all good and it's all love and light and everything's going to be, you know, pink roses, because that's not how life is. Even if you're an enlightened being, I think you're still going to have to suffer and be sad, and people will disappoint you, and the world will be impermanent, because that's what it is, right?
Something else that I kind of learned this year during the pregnancy, I did 2 Zen retreats at a new center for me, and it's also a fairly new center. It's a young group of monastics at the Center for Mindful Learning in Vermont. And their teacher is a pretty young guy named Soryu. He grew up in Burlington and then spent time in Asia, mostly Japan, training in Zen. And so what he is teaching is this perfect mix of, you know, kind of American deep ecology and kind of concern for the environment and concern for, you know, civil rights and kind of equality, mixed with this kind of classic Japanese Zen style. And I don't think this is, you know, I never know what the etiquette is in Buddhism, because I'm not, you know, I haven't taken vows, but I'll leave a lot of the details out because this was in a conversation. You have these personal one-on-one meetings with the teacher during the retreat. And I think the etiquette is you're not supposed to like talk about it afterward, but I don't know. I mean, that's like where most of the really useful stuff comes from, other than the sitting practice. And basically, I mean, the general story is I was sharing with him my desire to work with people who were dying. And I said, I can't do that yet because I'm still scared to die. And basically what he said is, you know, were you scared when you were with your sister? And I said, no, not at all. And he said, you have to do it from that space. And what I realized was that you can only help people die from a space of love. If you are trying to help people die from any other angle, you know, whether it's, I mean, it could be compassionate, well-motivated, well-intentioned, whatever. If it's not from that space of unconditional love, it's likely that you will get in the way and that their death will be less smooth than if you are coming from an unconditional space of love. And for me, with my sister, it was so easy to help her die because I was naturally in that space with her. And in that space, there is no separation. There is no loss or missing or leaving. It's just everything's already there. And we know that from the psychedelic space. But what I can say from watching my sister die is it's real. It's not just something that happens when you take a chemical. And it's very hard to remember that. So I feel like everything kind of came back around through the contemplative angle of, here's this like kind of classically trained teacher saying, you can't help people die unless you know how to love. And so, yeah, it's like I had this goal of like, I want to help people die. And instead, the universe is like, you're going to be a mom. And I feel like the motherhood piece is teaching me how to do that other thing that was this long-term goal of mine, which is to help people die. You know, it's not going to be good enough to just give people psilocybin, you know, or just, unless we can figure out how to really love the people that we're taking care of, it's not going to work. It doesn't matter what medicine we have. So I guess kind of it's helping this time away from, you know, I left Hopkins, I'm still speaking. I haven't done almost any writing. So it's this real time away from the psychedelic research world. I feel like in a way is helping prepare me to kind of step back in when the time is right. And it's teaching me all the ways in which I was kind of faking it as a guide. And I don't say that I harmed anyone, but I do think that a lot of people guide people on psychedelic journeys when they themselves aren't really clear about their own motivations. And so this is kind of helping me clear out all that stuff. Like, why am I really doing this? Is it about me or is it about actually taking care of someone? So yeah, it's like, it's all the work. You also can't hide from the work. It's like, even when you're not working, it's there.
Yeah. the people that I know who are the best at facilitating these kinds of experiences are people who are just like completely present and are able to not sort of force themselves or their will onto the experience. It's just like, there's an article that I read not too long ago that was all about sort of defining the concept of holding space. And it was specifically focused, the person who wrote it was worked in hospice, so it was specifically talking about death and dying, but she also does other sort of, in the articles for a mainstream publication, so she may have been talking about the psychedelic work, but it was very generalized. And she kept using this term, holding space, and it was like this, the article is almost like this meditation on that, and how when you're in that place and you're, like you're saying, helping someone die, what you're doing, I think, by helping really is just to like give them a place where they can be who they are and be safe and feel like whatever happens to me in this space is acceptable or it's okay. And the people that are the best at facilitating psychedelic experiences are those same, they have that same quality of, you know, that whatever you do in that space, they're going to be okay with it, and they're going to be there to like support you in your whatever emotion you have and in whatever comes out of your body. And does that sort of resonate with you?
It definitely resonates, and it also brings up for me one of my kind of concerns about the future of medicine with psychedelics added. My concern is that if we go the path of prescription medication, it would probably open the world of psychedelics up to a lot of people who wouldn't normally have access. So that would be positive. But my concern is that I don't think the best guides are going to be medical doctors. And so what I would hope is that we don't end up with just an experience and a pill that is supposed to help people die, but doesn't help them. And then all of a sudden we're kind of backed ourselves into a corner where we put all of this money, all of this time, all of this effort into getting legalized psychedelic medicine, and then the very people who are the best at guiding aren't allowed in the room. And what I mean by that is some of the best people I know are not trained medically, are not therapists, are not anybody special. They are just someone who knows how to be with people. Some of them call themselves shamans, some of them don't. Some of them are chaplains, work in hospice. It's like these kind of people who've just led fairly quiet lives focused on others. Mm-hmm. These are not people who get to speak at conferences. They're not people that most psychedelic people in the psychedelic community even know about. I mean, there are the famous people, the famous shamans, you know, the kind of VIPs. These are not that's not who I'm talking about. These are just the people who are kind of, I mean, doing God's work every day, taking care of people. And in the future that a lot of the popularly funded research is headed, those people don't have a seat at the table. I don't know what the answer is, because it seems like most people believe the only path is to first legalize something as a prescription and then see what else comes. But I don't know. I think that we could be a little bit more creative and think about the first step not being so narrow and saying, well, let's imagine the future we really want rather than a kind of so-so future that we can accept and then like, right, and like keep hoping that the future we want will come. It's like, let's just go to that right away. I remember having a conversation with one of my supervisors at Hopkins, and he was saying, you know, something about the FDA, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, how old is the FDA? He's like, what do you mean? I was like, it hasn't been around that long. What if it's not around in another 50 years? Why should we plan for a future that involves the FDA if it might not even be there? And he's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, forget that. What if none of these institutions are here? Like, why on earth would we focus all of our efforts on fitting something like psilocybin into institutions that could have dissolved in another 50 years? Like, let's really think long term in the whole scope of
human history.
Right, in human history. And these medicines have been around for thousands of years, possibly tens of thousands. So, like, let's think in 1,000 years from now where we could be with all of our technology and our understanding of the medicine and the brain and everything, and with psychedelics being more mainstream, rather than just like, oh, let's find this tiny little box and fit it in there, and then everyone can have that little box death experience rather than like an actual liberating experience. But yeah, those ideas aren't too popular in academia right now, which is probably why I took my departure when I did.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. As we're both parents of daughters, and one of my biggest concerns as my daughters grow older is that the world will impose itself on them and force them to be people that they aren't, or make them fit into boxes that they don't fit into, or tamp down their dreams in some way. And you know, you and I have shared some conversations about your concerns with the academic world in terms of the place of women, and I'd like to hear from, you know, from your perspective a little bit about that and what you see as like potential solutions.
Well, I'll start by saying that up until I began my post PhD life, I think I was very lucky in that I had male supervisors, male mentors at the undergraduate and graduate level who ran their research labs from a totally, you know, an equality standpoint. Men, women, different ages, didn't matter. Even different levels of education, everyone was considered equal. So by the time I arrived at Johns Hopkins, I was wholly unprepared for how hierarchical it would be, how patriarchal it would be, and how much I would have to fight to have my voice heard as a woman, as a young woman. And I want to preface this all by saying that I greatly valued my time at Hopkins. I really respect a lot of the people I worked for, and I don't even think that some of them knew, quote, what they were doing. But the whole atmosphere is really not supportive of women, and especially young women. Of course, I never actually practiced being a mother there. Sure. I kind of wish I had stuck around in order to do that, because it might have been cool to enact some change from that perspective. But I can offer a couple tidbits. So, you know, this is a story I actually have never shared. And I'll try to be, again, as general as possible. It's not my goal to, you know, point out different people. Sure. But so my sister died in January of 2013, and I came back after a month. And almost around the time that I came back, this beloved and wonderful security guard who had always basically protected the entire building in order to allow all of this drug research to happen his whole life, he had just died unexpectedly. Well, it was a little bit expected, but basically he had just retired a few months before, and he found out he had stage 4 cancer. He had had low back pain for years, but he thought it was just because of his job. It turns out he had had cancer throughout his abdomen that manifested as this low back pain. At the faculty meeting, one of the senior faculty members announced his death, and I don't know if there was emotion, and it wasn't that this person said it to be unloving or kind of disrespectful, but this person said, I guess he won't get to enjoy his retirement. And at that moment, I knew that I had to leave. That I was like, I just went through this with my sister. And to hear someone's life spoken about as an item at a faculty meeting, and with so little concern for the real loss of this person that everyone around that table knew so well. And I imagine lots of people at that table felt the way I did, that it was just so coarse to talk about this person's life that way. And I realized that that's the culture at Hopkins. Work takes such priority, and a work of such caliber that you don't allow yourself time to care about anyone else. And so the whole culture is basically geared toward keep going no matter what. It's like we're in a war, and it's like, oh, your best friend just died, keep going. You know, your colleague just suffered this horrible loss or is like really depressed and is suffering. Well, so what? Keep going. And you end up with people who are kind of shells with this stripped down, like we talked about, the soul is missing. And I thought to myself, I don't want this to happen to me.
So of course there were happy people. There are happy people at Hopkins with souls intact. And maybe the most amazing thing about a place like that is that even though the institution makes it so difficult for people to be whole and truly themselves, that there were still people who were generous and compassionate and some of the best people I've had the privilege to work with. The two people who taught me how to guide, Bill Richards and Mary Casamano, if there was any other reason that I ended up at Hopkins, I feel grateful that I got to spend time with them and to learn from their example. And I will take that with me for the rest of my life, not just in guiding psychedelic sessions, but in so many domains of life, just seeing how they relate to people and how they supported people in sessions. Mm-hmm. And how they supported me when I was going through tough times. And then two really amazing mentors, this woman, Annie, who is the physician on the psilocybin studies and did a number of other projects, including studies of mindfulness for addiction, and Gwen Smith, who is a fairly new faculty member who did brain imaging studies. And she and I had all sorts of plans to combine her forces with mine and take over the world and make Hopkins a better place. And I'm sure she's still doing that from her position there. And I think they're the lucky ones who managed to bring out the best in themselves and others in a very difficult environment.
A friend of mine and colleague and I used to joke about that we liked most of the people that we worked with, just not their work versions of them. And I even thought that about myself. I like me, I just don't like work me. And I was like, you know, I want a life where I don't have to say that. Yeah. That it's not a version of myself that I have to live most of my waking hours. So it was my sister's death that really kind of illuminated things for me, that I felt I didn't want to live in that culture any longer. But also, I began to hear different things from other women. Like one woman I know had to go back to work very soon after she gave birth to her child, and it wasn't because anyone told her she had to. It was just that she felt she might lose an opportunity to teach, which contributed a significant amount to her salary. And the way it works at Hopkins and other research medical institutions is every faculty member actually pays their own salary. None of the universities actually pay anybody. The faculty are coming up with their own money through grants. So what that means is if you have a child and you decide to take time off, even if it's approved and it fits all the federal guidelines for medical leave, if that happens in the middle of a grant cycle where you can't submit a grant and you don't get that grant, then that means that maybe a year from then, your job is not renewed. So in reality, places like Hopkins are discriminating against young women who want to have families. Because what it's saying, the message is, you might lose your job if you decide to have a child, which is the opposite of why we have family medical protection for leave, because it's supposed to promise that your job is there when you get back. Right. So again, I can't speak to what would have happened if I had gotten pregnant there. It might have been that I could work something out and the department would have been really supportive, but that's not what I saw before I left. What I can say is that when I decided to take a year leave, which was granted to me as a faculty member. It's in the contract. You can ask for up to a year leave for any reason. My supervisor said, you know, unfortunately, I can't promise that you'll have a job if you decide to come back. And I said, well, you can't promise that I'll have a job anyway. Like, even if I stay, if I can't get grants, there's no job security anyway. And he's like, yeah, you're right. So it's just like, wait, what are we talking about here? Like, this is insanity. And so it sucks for both men and women in that work environment, and it just sucks a little bit more for women. And in a way that I think in 2015, we should have figured out how to make places like that more compatible with what a lot of women want to do, which is have families. Otherwise, I mean, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation just announced, I think, 52 weeks of maternity leave and unlimited time off. It's like all the best minds are going to go elsewhere.
Sure.
You know, academia is not going to be able to retain the smartest and most driven women if they can't figure out how to give them more than a week of maternity leave. So it's unfortunate, but I do think these institutions are kind of dissolving themselves at this point. I'm happy to have gotten out when I did, and I just, maybe there's a future that involves them being more, you know, more in line with kind of equality and non-discrimination, but it's hard to see what's going to motivate them to change when, you know, I leave and there's someone right next, you know, in the ranks waiting to take my place. So nobody's missing me now.
Right.
Everything's turning along. The machine is fine. Although I guess I get the last laugh because I get to live on a farm with an awesome baby and and have lots of free time. But
I see this also as kind of a disease of our society that maybe transcends not just the culture of Johns Hopkins, but that we, you know, we, our country has, you know, the lowest amount of paid sick leave and paid vacation of any first world nation. We say that we have family values, but we don't, you know, we don't want to take care of, provide health care for people. We don't want to give people time off with their families. It's all about work, work, work. And in many, many, many different realms of American business and society. And that does impact women proportionally more than it does men. But what do you think we can do to change it or make it better?
So my cousin is about 15 years older than me, and she entered into kind of a corporate job working for an accounting firm in California at the time when things were just beginning to get a little bit better for women at the like top levels of leadership in corporate America. And she said mostly what inspired the change was more women getting into these positions of leadership, that until the women were at the top, nothing was really going to change. But once there was a kind of a tipping point where enough women were in positions of leadership, things started to change. Things like flex time and law firms and accounting firms in a way are way advanced beyond this, because they figured it out early on. They're like, we're going to lose our advantage if we can't figure out how to give women flexible time off. And then, of course, it applies to men too, and then they get the best of both. It's like, we want the best candidates for our company. So the best people tend to want to live a life that's not, you know, as rigidly structured. So let's give them flexible time off. But it's interesting, when I was telling her about all of this, she said, well, why don't you just start your own research center that hires all the best women? And she's like, not that you're going to be discriminating against the men, but just hire all the best women and have that be your focus. And, you know, she's like, it's probably justified. She didn't know much about psychedelics. But she said, you know, it sounds like a lot of what's required in these sessions is kind of that care and attentiveness that, I mean, just biologically, women are kind of tend toward, that empathy and kind of that mothering.
Yeah.
Not to say, again, that men aren't great support, you know, in psychedelic sessions, but most of the best guides I know are either women or gay men. And I don't know why that is, but it's just my sampling bias. So she's like, yeah, and just if you want to give the opportunities to these women, you could just do that rather than try to fight within an institution that's already against you. Start your own thing. And I still feel like that's a long-term goal of mine. I haven't figured out how to do it yet in a way that doesn't just recreate the same problems. And in a way that I still have my joy and free time in my life. You know, it's like, I think we all really respect and love Rick Doblin, but he has given his life for MAPS.
100%.
And he also has an amazing family life, but I look at how much he works and I'm like, I don't know if I'm cut out for that, you know? So it's like, I hope that if I start my own organization or center, it doesn't require that kind of work commitment. Maybe it does. Or maybe there's a time in my life where that all of a sudden feels the right thing to do. But yeah, I kind of go back to that advice that she gave. She said, if you want to see things change, you have to make those things change. Again, kind of speaking generally, protecting the innocent. I have a friend who is training in, is getting an advanced degree and who has been involved in psychedelic research. And she said, kind of, you know, just give me a few years and I'll be ready for you to hire me. And I've had other people say that to me, that, you know, it's not just me. A lot of people are kind of tired of the same old institutions. So yeah, I think that's what's churning in my brain. I haven't really put anything into practice yet, but I mean, another thing that I would like to see happen, I mean, with respect to working with dying people, is instead of medical institutions and even hospice, to have places that are more home-based environments, sure, that support people who are ill, people who are dying, their families. So living on this farm, although we're not doing that work directly here, it's helping me learn what is restorative for people, mm-hmm, being around nature, being around animals. So it's really helping me to be away from literally the physical institutions and living more next to nature.
Yeah.
So that I can better imagine a future where, you know, if we build a place that's really awesome, what would it look like? What would it feel like so that people feel comfortable dying there? And then whether you have psychedelics or not is just a little bit of an add-on.
Sure.
You know, we can make an amazing experience for people without any change in drug laws or any access to different medication.
I've thought a lot about, like, how do we transform the workplace or reinvent the concept of work? And, you know, Terrence McKenna had talked about, like, the archaic revival, and that when a society finds itself backed into a corner, that they sort of go back in time to a place where they felt safe, or where there's, like, rules or conceptualization that can help them sort of find their way out of that corner. And I worked a lot of years in restaurants, and I saw so much dysfunction in people who worked in restaurants. There's drug addiction, infidelity, depression, anger. Everybody's either a cokehead or an alcoholic or both. And I actually had an experience when I was a culinary student, where I had we went to an event and we came back to the home of my chef, and he got in this huge argument with his wife in front of me. I was like, you know, I was 19 years old, and this guy's screaming at his wife and the kid's baby's crying and stuff. And we went out on the porch and he looks at me, he says, "Do you have a girlfriend?" And I said, "Yeah." I was living with my now wife at the time. And he said, "You need to get the hell out of this business right now." And I've thought a lot about that, how much dysfunction there is in the restaurant business. And when I left the restaurant business and just started studying anthropology and the history of human civilization, and I realized that the restaurant industry stemmed from these, like, inns in the Middle Ages, where people just opened their home to travelers. So the restaurant industry is this thing where you're, like, always working. You're always there to, like, feed people at dinner time and to take care of them, to, like, be home for them. So we separated that business from the home. Mm. And it used to be a family business. The kids would wash the dishes while mom cooked, and, you know, dad took care of the horses for the guests outside. And we separated that from that business from the family, and we told people, you still need to have those same hours, but you're going to be off here someplace while your family is over here. And so, like, for me, a re-envisioning of work, and I just thought of this while you were talking, because it's like, and then you're saying, like, you know, creating a hospice where you just open your home for people to die here, or you have, you know, there's in Europe, they have these things called agriturismo centers, where people come to, like, farms, and it's like bed and breakfast / work your ass off at a farm. right?
That's what we need.
Yes. And and I think that, like, I think that there's so many industries that could be transformed that way, whether it's research or the restaurant industry or hospice, that to just, like, bring it back to the family and have, and, like, be, have, like, an apprenticeship system where, like, you're teaching your children your work and they're just there with you.
It's funny because one of my first, when I just kind of sketched out some ideas for, like, my ideal research center, it involved, like, places for communal living. So basically, in a way, it's like allowing people to work those crazy hours that are required sometimes for academic research. But it, like you're saying, instead of feeling like I'm away from the people I love, it's like I'm right here with the people I love, whether that's family or friends. And, you know, you'd give people, we had an idea about forced vacation. So every, I forget what it was, like every year you had to take like a month off, no matter what, no matter where you were in whatever project. And you knew that the group would keep it going for you and everyone would get credit. So no one would be worried about like, if I leave and I won't get authorship or whatever bullshit, you know? But yeah, it did look a lot more like a home-based research center. And yeah, with the dying, with birth, I mean, I gave birth here at home. In so many ways, we've been taught to fragment or compartmentalize our lives. And I mean, as my husband will say, it's really hard to live with the people that you're working with 24/7. We've tried that and we've learned that it's actually sometimes nicer to have a little bit of space. And I know that John's business partner would agree. And especially since we're both starting our, you know, having our first children. But for me, having John here all the time, even though he's probably working more than he did before when he had a classic job where he commuted, it means that he gets to be with me and Francis a lot more. And it may not, it may be fewer breaks for him for work, but it's more breaks for family. And so there are all these trade-offs. And yeah, I think you're onto something, that if we just figure out a way to make living and working not so different.
Yeah.
And not in the way that workaholics mean, which is my work becomes my life.
Right.
But they're both completely still there.
Yeah.
And they're not so separate. And then again, we won't have these horrible situations where someone works their whole life, finally retires to be with their family and dies of cancer, like the security guard. And we won't have people saying, oh, well, I guess you didn't get to enjoy your retirement, as if you don't get to enjoy your life until you retire, kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, let's move beyond that, you know? It's, yeah, it's got to be better.
Well, I just want to say this has been a wonderful conversation. And I would like to end with, as we were talking about sacrifice or giving through sacrifice, what is your opinion on the theological implications of The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein? As in, do you think that the little boy abused the tree? Or do you think that the tree is a bodhisattva?
I don't know. I think I'm going to have to withhold judgment until I reread that with my daughter when she's ready, because she probably has a lot more wisdom about it than I do. What I can say is that I've learned a whole lot more from the trees on this property than I have in a lot of my academic mentorships.
Nice answer. Thank you so much, Catherine. Thank you for sharing your home with us.
Thank you.